that wonderful phrase. To hear those three little words, that's all I live for the rest of my days. And when I feel in my heart they tell sincerely, no other words can tell it half so clearly.
Patricia T. O'Connor is here, author of a number of books on the language that have three-word titles. Woe is I, Words Fail Me, You Send Me, of course, and we fudged it a little bit with Woe is I, Junior, the version for kids. And now, just breaking the mold, coming out next May, Origins of the Species.
Well,
can I call it Origins
article.
Of Species?
Sure, sure.
Keep it
just
three
ignore
words.
The article.
And what is that going to be doing?
It's going to be out in May.
I mean, what is that going to cover that the other books haven't
covered? Oh, it is all about myths and misconceptions of English. For instance, that rule of thumb was based on some old British common law that you could beat your wife with a stick no bigger than your thumb. Or that...
Now you tell me.
Stuff like that. But it's etymology and all these things.
Yeah.
So,
well, we take calls when you come by. Lots of calls. 212-433-9692. People also will leave all sorts of interesting questions on our show page at WNYC.org. But you come in here usually with something that you want to get off your chest.
Well, there is something on my mind, actually. Last time I was here, there was the briefest little mention of a little factoid that's been making the rounds, that English is approaching a million words.
And I think I said it because I read it in the newspaper.
Well, I wasn't going to blame you, but yeah, it was in the newspaper.
Is that
true? It was in the Times again. It has been making the rounds a lot and whizzed by me at the time, but I'd like to set the record straight. It's not true, so don't believe it.
I so wanted to believe that.
Well, let me talk about how this got around. There's a marketing company in Austin, Texas called Global Language Monitor. And it regularly makes this claim. Its latest prediction is that on or around April 29th, 2009, English will surpass 1 million words.
It should have been April 1st, don't you think?
That would have been appropriate. But actually, the company has made the same claim in 2006, 2007, and 2008, and always with a lot of hoo-ha. And each time the gullible press has, for the most part, swallowed the story whole. And this is the same company, keep in mind, that last fall got a lot of coverage on CNN for putting out what it called grade-level analyses of key debates and speeches. And it gave Obama a 7th grade level rating and Sarah Palin a 10th grade level rating. Those grade level ratings are ridiculous anyway,
don't understand that. Were they saying that Sarah Palin was more articulate than Barack Obama?
Well, they didn't put it in those words, but when Sarah Palin debated Joe Biden, they gave Biden an 8th grade rating and Palin a 10th grade rating. And when Obama had his victory speech in November, they gave him a 7.4 grade rating.
Well, this sounds like there's a political aspect, or else are these people hoaxers?
Well, I don't like to use that word, but that's a pretty good word, I think, for what they're doing. But back to the number of words in English. The company, and keep in mind, it's a marketing company, and its specialty is language, and it likes to get its name in the press a lot. The company says it arrives at its prediction on the number of words by using a kind of proprietary software that searches all available sources for new and developing words. Of course, it won't reveal this secret algorithm because it's proprietary. But you're probably wondering, how many words are there really?
Well, if you consider algorithm three separate words.
Right. And he had a lot of rhythm. Didn't he do the Lambada at one time?
He did.
Okay. Well, at any rate, the people at the Oxford English Dictionary say that this is an impossible question to answer because how would you count? Like, take a word like drive. It's a noun and it's a verb, so that's two. Mm-hmm. But what about plural? Do you count drives? And what about the inflections of the verb? Do you count drives, drove, driven, driving. If you did that,
What about all the different meanings of drive? We're going
exactly
to have a fundraising
all the different
drive
senses,
soon.
Right. Perfect example. Now, if you multiply all those nouns by all the possible senses they could have, all the nouns in English and all the verbs in English by all the possible verbal inflections,
you'd have distraction.
Yeah, right. So that's why it's rather a silly question. And what about scientific terms? There are over 80 million names of chemical substances.
80 million?
Named chemical substances. There are millions upon millions of plant and animal species that have names. There are 1 million insects alone. And how about place names? That would give us millions more. And what about a number? Say the number 5, if we write it out. That's a word, of course. But does every number get a word? We'd have trillions then. Mm-hmm. So it's misleading. But back to reality. The OED says we probably have a quarter to three-quarters of a million words, excluding technological and regional terms and excluding all verbal inflections and things like that. So
we could be grateful because, you know, my staff brings dictionaries down for us just in case.
What if they had trillions and trillions of words? They'd need a forklift. But when April rolls around, you'll probably see a lot more hoo-ha pay it no never mind. And in case you're wondering what's magical about April, since a lot of previous deadlines have passed since 2006, the company's president has published a book, A Million Words and Counting, that comes out in paperback in April. Mm. But that's probably just a coincidence.
You're listening to WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and with me is Patricia T. O'Connor. We are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Should we take calls, or you have something else you want to talk about?
Yeah, let's take calls.
Okay, let's go to Marion from Manhattan. Hi, Marion, you're on the air.
Hi. I've really been enjoying this segment. I always enjoy it when you come, Ms. O'Connor. I have a question that's actually really a comment on pronunciation. I've noticed that not only the general public, but even announcers on television and even, God forbid, on NYC say jewelry.
Not me.
Rather than jewelry. No, never you. And I just wonder if...
because I've wondered about this as well. What's wrong with jewelry? It's a perfectly easy word to pronounce, Pat. Is it?
Yes. It is. It's spelled differently in Britain, which makes it look like jewelry. But here we generally say jewelry. But I'm just now looking it up in American Heritage, and I'll bet you $10 that both are
but
listed
not but not jewelry, and that's what an
oh,
awful...
Oh, jewelry.
Yeah, that's
jewelry,
what...
Jewelry, yes.
And I've heard many educated people say, I have this jewelry. It's
no,
like
it's
February.
I'm wrong. There's only one pronunciation listed, jewelry.
Thank
jewelry.
You.
Not jewelry.
So I don't know why. It's just, I guess it's one of those things where a mispronunciation like mayoral
mm-hmm.
becomes mayoral.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are others that I guess nobody's going to insist on exquisite as opposed to exquisite.
Right. But then there's that athlete named Favre. Mm-hmm. I can't think of his first name.
Yeah, and it should be Favre.
It's spelled F-A-V-R-E, but his family pronounces it Favre, and... Hey, that's their prerogative.
And now he's going to retirement, so we don't even have to worry about that anymore. Thank you so much for calling us. And we go to Tom from Brooklyn. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I'm calling about the use of different than and also a couple books. Instead of saying different from, I hear different than. And instead of a couple of books, a couple books. I see that on the New York Times.
Mm-hmm. First, different. It's perfectly okay to say different than if what follows is a clause. For example, I'm different than I was 5 years ago.
Oh, I see.
Paris is different than it was 5 years ago, but Paris is different from London. So if it comes before a clause, it's perfectly normal to use than. And Your other question
was
I'm
a
sorry.
Couple. He said
oh,
that
couple
people
of.
Have dropped out that of.
Right, we long ago dropped it out in front of number or say a hundred or dozen, a couple hundred, and I think that partly because of that, it's also falling away in other usages, and although the usage guides now would tell you to put couple of in, I'm guessing that in a few more years that'll probably fall away. These things do come and go. It's sometimes hard to accept that they aren't written in stone.
Well, the problem is that for people who are used to saying it the old way, alarm bells go off, and even if the new way is perfectly correct, it stops us for a moment.
Right.
I know that happens to me when I hear somebody say between you and I or something like that. I can't hear the rest of the sentence.
Right. And yet
and I feel like I'm being an idiot.
No, people who are used to saying between you and I, it's very hard for them to absorb the information about, you know, following with an objective pronoun instead of a subject. So it's habit is very compelling in language. It's hard to change our habits.
Thank you so much for your call. We go now to Robert from Pelham, New York. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Leonard. This is my first time on the show. I'm very pleased to do that.
Welcome aboard.
I have wondered about why people say absolutely instead of yes. Seems to be a current thing. Why and has that happened?
Well, only one reason, I think, really, and that's that people get bored with saying yes. So they try to pump it up a little by saying absolutely.
Now, why does that bother you? One of the great things about the English language, as far as I'm concerned, is that we can use many different words to get across the same idea. That enriches the language. If we only had one word for each thing, wouldn't that make the language a lot more boring?
Well, yeah, these things do go in and out of fashion.
It troubles me because I want to get to the next point, and you have to go through four syllables to get to the next point as opposed to just yes and then on.
I see. It is less economical. That's true.
Yes.
Even you betcha would save a syllable.
Well, yeah, well, we could just find a way to streamline the language, couldn't we? But there's also the rhythm of a sentence. Sometimes I've written a sentence that is perfectly fine, and yet I've added a word here or there because it just seemed too blunt.
It may be that in a conversation, yes may be too abrupt. Maybe you're having a leisurely conversation and you want to fill up a little more space phonetically.
But doesn't it also sound more enthusiastic? Absolutely.
It does.
Positively.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yes. Yes sounds like the sort of answer that I get from guests who don't want to give me answers.
Right. And we get irritated at these things, but I think you'd get a lot more irritated if there were no variety in people's speech.
Thank you so much for your call. Now, our next caller is Dove from New York. Hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I was curious about the word jingoism, meaning an excessive patriotism. What's the source of that? Do you know?
Yeah, actually, a few months ago, I answered an email question about this. It comes from, it started out as an interjection, by jingo. And then by association, it started becoming used in as the dictionary tells us, in the refrain of a bellicose, that's warlike 19th century English music hall song. And from there on, it became identified with extreme nationalism, chauvinism, overzealous patriotism, that kind of thing. So it started out as rather an innocent, just sort of interjection of, sort of an emphatic approval.
Hmm. Okay, but we don't know where the
where the actual word jingo came from.
Was.
No, not as far as I know.
But do we know where golly comes from and any of those other words?
Golly actually is one of those mild euphemisms for the deity.
Ah.
God. By golly.
Well, maybe jingoism comes from the I Ching, jing, or something like that.
That's a good theory.
We'll be back with more of your calls to Patricia T. O'Connor after we take a little break. Stay with us. I wanted to alert you to our new LoPage Show listener contest. We're asking you to sum up your life in just 6 words. Submit your 6-word memoir, and then we'll announce the winners on Friday, February 27th. To find out more, in fact, we're going to sneak it in right before the end of February. To find out more and get some inspiration for your 6-word memoir, visit our show page at WNYC.org. And remember, 6 words is the limit.
What I'd give to hear those 3 little words. Man, that's such a wonderful phrase. To hear those 3 words.
We're back with Patricia T. O'Connor, and we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. People are also leaving messages, comments on our show page. And Sarah from Ridgewood left this comment. She said, I saw a commercial last night, and the following was said. This is something I think that's right up your alley because of your You Send Me book. It said, you can send email from Spain. And she wonders, should it be email or emails? Mail is singular, she says, and plural. But is it different for email?
No, I think email as a generic collective kind of thing. Like you can send mail from Spain. I don't see any problem with using email as a collective singular thing, mm-hmm. as well as saying, I got 3 emails the other day. I don't see any problem with that.
Well, people hand you a bunch of letters and say, here's your mail.
Right.
They don't say, here's your mails.
Right, and you say, I'm going to check my email. I'm not going to check my emails. So I don't see any problem there myself.
Well, I guess this brings us back to that earlier question of whether more than one mouse becomes mice or whether you have a lot of mouses with all the computers in the office.
I think that issue has been decided, but I can't remember which way, whether a computer mouse it pluralizes the same way as a rodent. I can't remember. I only have one myself, so it doesn't matter.
Say, yeah, I think it's mouses. Is it? Along these lines, talking about email, Natalie from Katona has a question. Hi, Natalie.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on the show.
And what do you want to talk about?
Okay, well, my question was, I've caught myself doing this and other people as well. While text messaging, one person will text, I love you, and the next person will text back, ditto.
Mm-hmm.
And when I type ditto, I always think I love you too, or mm-hmm. love you as well.
Right.
But in my understanding, the word ditto actually simply, like, literally repeats the phrase before it. Does it work that way? Does that word, like,
so you're suggesting, Natalie, that when you say ditto, you're saying, yeah, I love myself too.
Right. It kind of works it a little bit by using ditto, I think, but it works so nicely in a text message.
Well, actually, I'm looking at the American Heritage definition, and it says the same as stated above or before, a duplicate or a copy. But I think most of the time when somebody says, I love you, and the other person says ditto, he or she is saying, I second that emotion, to use a Motown term.
Because people also say, me too, they definitely mean, I love you too.
Mm-hmm. Now, actually, there's a usage note here. This is interesting. The Italian detto, D-E-T-T-O or D-I-T-T-O, meant what said does in English. as in the locution, the said story. Hmm. But ditto actually comes from, it's past participle of the Latin verb dicere.
So do we owe a detto Italian?
We're in their detto.
Ezra from Harlem left a comment on our show page. He said, can you, we please, please call for the demise of oftentimes.
I don't know why
it bothers him.
You know, at one time we had an old expression, oftentimes. I don't know if it preceded often, but oftentimes and oftentimes was once pretty much a standard part of the language. So oftentimes it has a
kind
of Victorian ring.
Doesn't it?
Well, it does feel redundant. You could call it a kind of emphatic redundancy. But redundancy isn't always so bad.
It's, again, the rhythm of the language.
Right, right.
Wendy from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Great show. I have two things. One is a sort of pet peeve, and another one is a question. So my pet peeve is when people say second of all or third of all, because it seems to me that it's not actually second of all. It's second of everything but the first. So you should say secondly or thirdly.
Well, should we say secondly instead of second?
Right, or secondly. But to say, I mean, I can understand saying first of all, but I don't understand going beyond that.
Right. I think second of all and third of all are probably just made on the analogy of first of all.
Right.
But as for saying whether you say second or secondly, I think secondly sounds a little unnecessary. Why make it an adverb?
Uh-huh.
Just say second or third,
right,
or fourth rather than fourthly.
But a lot of educated people write secondly, thirdly.
Yeah, they do.
And I've wondered how and it goes back a long time.
I don't know why they do. Maybe they're thinking along the terms of additionally. I don't know. But I think it's a little unnecessary.
So my second thing is a question. I find myself, especially recently, I write in a notebook that I send to my daughter's school giving information about what she has done. She's 2 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I find myself using the word so a lot, saying, she's so cute, she was so cute doing this. And
mm-hmm.
It really feels, I mean, I do it because I think I speak that way, but is that an incorrect use of so?
No, not at all.
It feels like something else is supposed to come after that, or...
Not necessarily.
So you could say so cute. So very cute.
It may be that it started drawing your attention because you repeat yourself a lot, but it's nothing wrong with it.
What I'm hearing a lot is people starting their sentences with so. I will often, in fact, people from the sciences, mm-hmm. I will ask them a question about black holes, and they'll say, so these forces.
Believe it or not, I've gotten a lot of emails about that. They'll say, sometimes I listen to interviews on the radio, and they respondent will start his reply with, so, why is that? It's probably just a little bit of a delaying tactic, a little bit of padding.
There are other times when you say so, like, so, you're saying, because of that, why? So, why did you such and such?
Yeah.
You're referring to the previous
right,
sentence.
You're
transitional
talking about something
word.
That came first. So why did you do that?
Mm-hmm.
Or so what happened after that?
And that's perfectly uh-huh. okay.
Sure.
It?
So is a very useful word.
And you can reap an awful lot from it, can't you? Michael from Staten Island, hi.
Good afternoon. Great show.
Wait, before we go on, Pat, I want to thank you so much for laughing at these very lame jokes of mine.
I love lame jokes.
Michael, go ahead.
Yeah, I have two questions. One involves the word up. More and more you hear the term used as we upped it instead of increased or expand.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in that same...
we upped the ante.
In that same category, the word grow, we're going to grow the economy.
Mm-hmm.
I always ascribe the term grow to something organic.
Yeah.
And finally, the third thing that I have is how the plural is being lacking more and more. For instance, men's store, M-E-N apostrophe S instead of M-E-N-S mm-hmm. apostrophe.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll leave it at that.
Okay, let me work backwards. The business about men's store with an apostrophe S, and the reason the apostrophe S, oh, excuse me for clearing my throat into the mic, the reason for the apostrophe S is people are treating it as a possessive, which they could. It's not incorrect, but it's also correct not to use the possessive and consider it an attributive noun, like girls' basketball team. What kind of basketball team is it? It is a basketball team composed of girls. So you can. There are a lot of things that you can look at either as a plural or as an attributive adjective. Then to remind me again, your previous. I'm sorry, I tend to forget what I started with.
The other one was a word up.
Right, up. That's become a verb. It's legitimate as a verb now, and I think it's understandable, and it's more economical than increase. So I think that's probably a natural development of the language. And the other one, grow, using that in that way, I admit that's very, it sounds like corporate gobbledygook to talk about to grow an economy, to use it transitively that way as if you were talking about grow a crop. And you don't mean it in the same way as grow a crop. They're using grow to mean to increase something, to increase the economy, to grow it. I don't like that usage, and I wish it would fade into the sunset, but it's not up to me. Maybe it will, maybe it won't.
It'll either survive another 20 years and then become part of the language or disappear as mm-hmm. something else comes along.
Right.
The matter of apostrophes fascinates me because mm-hmm. I see them misused so much
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In store signs, for example,
right.
Where it's perfectly fine to have the a plural word.
Uh-huh.
And then they'll put an apostrophe before the S.
Oh, sure. Last week I got a letter, I actually get real mail sometimes, from a listener who cut out three different ads referring to President's Day. One of them had presidents, no apostrophe. One of them had presidents with S apostrophe. And one of them had president apostrophe S. So it was all three kinds of ways.
But this is kind of like the girls' basketball team.
Yes.
You don't need the apostrophe there.
No, but you definitely wouldn't say girl apostrophe team unless you're talking about one girl.
Right. A listener left this question, and I'm not sure we will know the answer. Where does the phrase kick the bucket come from?
Oh, gee.
I mean, there's a lot of kick things, like kick the habit.
Right.
But kick the bucket, why would a bucket mean something about death?
I don't know. Maybe it's from the farm, that when a cow is being milked and the person milking it has a stroke and falls over dead, the cow kicks over the bucket of milk or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Maybe somebody will write us.
Yeah, maybe.
In fact, that's something that I should remind people of. You can ask Pat a question directly or send her something if you know the answer. And often listeners know the answers to the questions that come up during the show and
mm-hmm.
send
they do.
Mail to me. Well, you can send it directly to Pat and bypass having me have to forward it to her. Just email her at mailbox@grammarphobia.com, or you can go to grammarphobia.com and click on Pat's blog to see a selection of language questions from other WNYC listeners. There is a question here from another listener, Richard in New York City. He wants to talk about the reason why. He said it seems to be commonly used, but surely it should either be the reason or why. Example, that was the reason I did it, or that was why I did it.
Well, I disagree about that. I don't necessarily see a redundancy in the reason why.
And
I think
why
if
is
you
that?
Said if you said the reason is because, that would be redundant, but I don't see the reason why necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I do this and the reason why I do this, granted, they mean the same thing, but I'm not bothered. It doesn't strike me as redundancy.
Another redundancy question now from Paul from Manhattan. You want to know about free of charge as opposed to just saying free?
How about plan in advance? That's another one.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello.
Yeah. I noticed people would say something like, hey, come in and get the second one for free. Shouldn't it be free of charge? And another one I thought of was like, people say, oh, I need to speak to you in private. Shouldn't it be, I need to speak to you privately or in privacy? I just always found that weird. And by the way, Ms. O'Connor, I do have a comment.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed this the last time we spoke once. People who say, let me get, when they go to the counter at McDonald's, say, let me get a number two.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they sit down in a restaurant, the same people, when a waiter comes to them, they don't say, let me get the chicken with asparagus. They say, may I please have the chicken and asparagus. So if I'm going to marry a woman, the deal breaker is if I hear her say, let me get, I'm going to think that she's just not culturally refined.
Well, are you going to propose to her in private or in privacy?
Leonard, I'm so glad to be on your show.
And are you going to take her to McDonald's? I mean, heavens to Betsy.
Well, the big question is, why do those things bother him? He thinks that free of charge is better than free. I would think opposite
is true.
No,
I would think, what's wrong with free? I'm bothered by free gift. I think that's a little bit redundant. It's so common now, though. It's almost ridiculous. But he sounds hard to get, doesn't he?
Yeah. Well, I was always bothered by free radicals. Because
What are they, anyway?
It turns out that they have nothing to do with politics. And all those years, I was thinking, well, why aren't those radicals in jail?
You know, that reminds me of another question, though, because there's always some little buzzword about women's cosmetics. It's free radicals, or it's antioxidants, or a few years ago it was alpha hydroxy acids. Everything had to have alpha hydroxy acids. Nobody ever knows what these things mean, but we go for them like lemmings every time. Now, what's a free radical? I know it has something to do with antioxidants, but what are antioxidants?
Pat O'Connor will be back with us on Wednesday, March 18th, and we will talk more about this. Meanwhile, you can contact her directly by going to mailbox@grammarphobia.com. Pat, it's always a pleasure to have you on this show, and it's always a lot of fun.
Thank you for having me.
On tomorrow's show, how the increased number of women in the legal profession has remade the law, plus a look at the acoustical makeover of Lincoln Center's Alice Tully Hall. Then chef and restaurateur John Turow tells you everything you want to know about beef, and our latest underreported segments. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neeschick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Jennifer Janish, Jesse Maple, Barbara Kahn, and Leslie Dickstein. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We will see you tomorrow. ¶¶